You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We're delighted that Lorna Hackett and Michael Mansfield KC are here with us. Lorna, a barrister with extensive litigation experience, particularly in the areas of judicial review and human rights, is going to be in conversation with Michael Mansfield KC, called to the bar in 1967, QC in 1989, and has represented defendants in some of the most controversial legal cases, particularly where issues of human rights, civil liberties have arisen. So today they're going to be leading us in a conversation. Around 30, 40 minutes, they're going to be giving us some input from the front, then we're going to open it up to the floor on the power of people's passion, perseverance, collectivity and courage, and how they have the ability to make lasting and positive change. Give a very big pagoda welcome to both of them, first-time Greenbelters, Lorna and Michael.
Panoramic view. Is this working? Can you hear?
Is this working?
Can. Oh, God. Yes. Right. I just wanted to make sure, because I like people to feel included, and people sitting down there, right over there, and as long as everybody can hear, that's fine. Lorna was just going to say something. I'm sorry to interrupt.
I was just going to say, is this working?
Well, you're catching up.
Shall I start?
I thought you were.
Yeah, I'm going to start. Okay, that's all right. We are delighted to be here. Yes, we've never been to Greenbelt before. It's fabulous to see so many of you here. Michael wrote a book last year in a bit of a rush because he's quite busy still. And it's called The Power and the People.
It's here.
Not the People in Power.
Fortunately, there are many more in the bookshop. You get two for the price of one today. No.
Have you told the bookseller?
No, I haven't told them that yet, but never mind.
So, one of the things that I helped Michael a bit with the book.
A lot.
And one of the things that he tasked me to do was to interview all the people whose lives, whose histories, whose struggles have been highlighted in the book and told, with the purpose of looking at perseverance and what you can really do if you put your mind to it in terms of achieving change. And one of the things that really struck me about everybody in that book was that they had this innate sense that what they were doing was the right thing, and that regardless of the circumstances, regardless of how long it took, they persevered. And that, to me, showed that regardless of where people came from, what their circumstances were, what their background was, they had this innate faith in their own sense of justice. And I wanted to ask you about what you thought, because you represented these people, what was it within them that you saw?
Well, I think it's part of it. I'm sure we're very keen to get your views on pretty well everything we're talking about, and do join in as soon as we take a short break after we've spoken to each other. But I think the most important motivating factor for me, and that's why I began writing the book in any event, I wasn't intending to, was the state of the nation 2 years ago. And, of course, it's deteriorated even more. And, of course, we make clear in the book who we hold responsible for this and who are the people who are going to make the changes. And that's why the title of the book, although passion, which has been mentioned several times, is a core of the book is called The Power in the People, Not, and it's in the small print at the bottom, Not the People in Power. And it's in order to say to people who I've met over my career, over 50 years now, is that I've been staggered, overwhelmed by the fact that you, just ordinary people, and in that sense, nobody's ordinary, everybody's extraordinary. And it's ensuring that the person knows that they do have this resource inside. It isn't about money, it isn't about material resources, it's about spiritual resources, which I know this festival will probably connect with better than most, probably. And I learned from the people I represented. And to give you an example, it's right in the news now. It will be in the news, yes, at the beginning, not this coming week, but the week after. The report on Grenfell Tower is going to be published on September the 4th. The BBC are running, and I don't know whether any of you have listened to it, I've just cottoned on, it's been on last week, BBC Building a Catastrophe. Building a Disaster is the title of this series of 10 on Radio 4, and it actually charts the progress of the inquiry, and what it does is what we do here, which is in the book, which is to interview people who are in the tower. You can't think, any of you, I'm sure, of a worse situation that is globally visualized on television and instant communication, is to find yourself stuck on the 23rd floor or the 22nd floor or the 21st floor and you can't get down. And as I'm hoping the inquiry will say, this was foreseeable, preventable, avoidable, all those things. But what's at the core of it are these voices of ordinary people who've lost everything. They've walked out of the tower with nothing, literally nothing. And yet, out of the ashes, they haven't had to wait so long, fortunately. And all the other people that are in here have had to wait longer, but they never give up. And that's another of the adages, never give up. Is keep your eye, they want you. They, being the people in power, want you to give up, exhausted, roll over, forget it, move on. All the phrases you've heard so many times. And so what we're trying to do is bring that together, and we were endeavouring to do it before the election. And we did it before the election, obviously, the book was out by then, in order to encourage people to turn away from the usual suspects and look at themselves and combine together. And, of course, we tell that story over and over again. And Lorna very kindly helped me interviewing some of the people who I'd represented over the years. They all say the same thing. They all say, at the end of the day, there were days when I felt, what's the point? Why should I get up even? You know, they don't want it, and they just feel they're failing. And the point we always make, or I always make, is you may feel you're failing, but success is within reach. The problem is you never know how close the reach is, but you have to keep trying. And those who do, in the end, they do succeed. And that's the point of the book. The ones, there are some who haven't got to that stage yet. We put those in the book as well. So that's a synopsis, really. So
You don't know this yet, I don't think. I read a review, I think it was on Amazon. Somebody wrote, thank you for this book, or something like this, I'm paraphrasing. Reading this book has made me want to change the world, but also that I could.
Ah. Who was this with? I need to know. Yeah, it's good news. Now, there have been some really extraordinary reviews that have been very heartwarming. People have written personally to me along those lines. But what one of them was, you know, I've never read a book in a day before, but I have on this one. We wrote it quickly, I wrote it quickly, and with Lorna's help, absolutely invaluable help, intending that you should pick it up and just read it, because it has a flow to it. And I think the other thing I just want to bring in at the moment, I'm afraid I do in all the talks I've given over the past year, I've been taking the book to all sorts of places. But it's a topic, and I'm afraid it's a topic I'm not going to shy away from. And I know that it's close to the hearts of a lot of you here. So I've got quite a bit to say on the environment, and I know that's another of the issues. But the issue that burns itself into my heart and soul at the moment isn't happening right here, but in a sense it is, and that's Gaza. I was saying to somebody outside, as I sit here now, hundreds, maybe hopefully not thousands today, are being killed for a completely unlawful purpose, I'm afraid. I'm saying it very clearly. And the position that I've adopted, because I've represented Palestinians, I've been to Palestine 3 times, there is an iniquity here. And it's an iniquity that was being perpetrated here by previous politicians, namely to turn your back on the law, the rule of law. What's the point? Are we back into a jungle situation in which might is right? I hope not, but we're very close to it. And that's the point that lawyers have a role to play. And that was another point behind the book, because it was inspired. I bring it because nobody's ever heard of this person. And I'm just going to ask if anybody here has. A man called Stefan Hessel. Has anybody heard his name? No. Oh, you have. That's one of the first people, a small group of people. He wrote a pamphlet called Indignez-vous. And really his message was, and this was written about 10 years ago, and it became viral. It became the inspiration for the Arab Spring. It became the inspiration for a lot of people in freedom movements throughout the world, because what he was saying was, be indignant, don't be indifferent. Important message. And what I discovered, and I had the privilege of working with him just before he died when he was writing this, because he was the inspiration behind the Russell Tribunal, which I sat on, dealing with problems in the Middle East, and particularly the Israel-Gaza, Israel-Palestine situation. But he was not necessarily well-known, certainly well-known in France. He became a diplomat for the French government after the Second World War. He'd been locked up twice in concentration camps, death warrants out all over the place for him. He escaped. He became an architect, along with Eleanor Roosevelt, of the United Nations Charter after the Second World War. And what he did, which galvanized him into setting up the Russell Tribunal, galvanized him into becoming an international diplomat, saying, what's the point of all the work I did after the Second World War to establish a regime which was supposed to prevent exactly what is happening, not just in the Middle East, but also in Sudan. You know all the theaters of war throughout the world. What has happened to the United Nations? All those questions that are burning at the moment. And so I'm just announcing it now just so it's known. I'm so caught up in it, and Emily, who's here somewhere, and Lorna, what we have asking to do this very moment is to see the new Attorney General, who is not unsympathetic to some of these issues, because there's a judgment. I just want to say, I'm not going to speak for too long on Palestine, but it's a burning issue for me, is that 2 weeks ago, there was a very important judgment it was an advisory opinion, to be absolutely accurate, by the International Court of Justice. It wasn't on the central issue of genocide. It was much more important. They have declared very clearly something that you knew and I have known for years. There has been, for 75 years, an unlawful occupation of the territory known as Palestine. 75 years! Now, this has important ramifications, and I don't think it's really been picked up on yet. There's a principle at law called erga omnes, which means basically when the crime, if you like, when the offense is so serious, the world's citizenry has an obligation to stand up. In other words, it's the power in the people finally comes into its own. From the moment they declared that advisory opinion, we have an obligation. We as citizens have an obligation to bring to bear on the Israeli authorities and Israeli economic companies, corporations, and so on, pressure to stop an illegality, because if they don't stop, then we will stop buying their goods and we will stop exporting arms and warfare, munitions, and so on, and fuel for their planes and so on. You know the list is as long as your arm. Now, we have an obligation as individuals. And that's effectively what the International Court of Justice has said on more than one occasion. This time it was very clear and distilled into one judgment, as it were. And this is what we want to see the English Attorney General and say, what are you going to do? What's your new government who's said it won't object to arrest warrants for Netanyahu and so on? So this is, I'm not sure whether somebody's trying to say something, but maybe they are. I don't mind if you do. But these facts, as far as I'm concerned, constitute a situation in which we have a communal obligation to change, which is what's the theme of the book is, and the theme of this pamphlet.
So what do we do about it?
Well, I mean, on a practical level, there are all sorts of campaigns, obviously, you can become involved in that are perfectly legitimate. Marches, boycott, there's something called BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. will now come into its own. You'd be perfectly entitled not to buy goods from the Dead Sea, from the lands that Israel has occupied, profits of which don't go back to the Palestinians but go into Israeli pockets and so on. Do anything that is entirely legal and permissible in order to put pressure on the... Because the Israeli government are not taking any notice of the rule of law as such, because up to now, if they were, they wouldn't be doing what they are doing now in the name of the law. They're pretending that it is in the name of the law. So I think that, I can name all the things that you can do. In other words, you can leave this tent and start to think about what you as an individual might wish to do. Some of you may be good at letter writing. Some of you may be better on marches. Some of you might like public speaking. I don't know. There are different things that we're all good at. But everybody's got a part to play. And I think this happened. There aren't many need for me to give you lots of examples. You know one. This is what happened with South Africa. It became isolated economically and politically, and it didn't have anybody it could speak to anymore. And eventually, the tide turned. And I think that's got to be the same approach with those countries. Israel is, as I say, not alone in this. There are other countries who've ignored the rule of law, and we have to start playing a role, because I use the analogy that, your freedom sitting in the front row is mine, and if you happen to live somewhere else, it's still mine, because we're part of the same human race. So we have an obligation to each other. We have an obligation to Palestinians to prevent the innocent who are being trashed every single day. The buildings and the people, a dreadful scene.
So,
sorry?
I'm going to talk about something which is very close to your heart.
Yes.
Because we didn't get an opportunity to talk about it last time, and I wanted to make sure we could talk about it.
Ah, right, okay.
Are you all right to talk about that now?
Yeah.
So, Michael, you've represented countless people throughout your life, but there's one sort of campaign that's extraordinarily close to your heart for very personal reasons, and so I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I do, actually. And I did a meeting with Lorna in Ireland last weekend, and somebody came up in the audience and said, we were expecting you to talk about it. And to be honest, there was so much else to talk about, it slipped the agenda.
That's why I'm getting it in now.
Yeah, you're right. Somebody, I think Andy, wherever he is, has got... There are little leaflets here, and I'd like those of you who are inclined to have a look at it. Because while I was doing the Hillsborough case, the inquests that were taking place up in the north at that time, not actually in Liverpool, but very near, in a place called Warrington, which you're probably very familiar with. That's where the inquests were being held. But one morning during these inquests, I got a phone call. And the phone call said, do you know what's happened? And it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, it's a very odd thing to be doing at 6 o'clock. Do I know what's happened? No, I don't. I've been asleep. And the voice just said, she's dead. And I, you're turning around in your mind. What? Who? Your daughter, Anna. That's it. Phone went dead. And she'd committed suicide. I was due to see her the next day. There were things troubling. I had no idea that it was that bad, as no one ever does. And so from that moment onwards, here was a soul had been in need here. There's no question about that. And you don't necessarily spot it, however close you are to somebody. So obviously having, as it were, antennae permanently geared towards discerning who's disturbed and who's not, it's really difficult but really important. So I gave a little speech at the memorial service for her, and there were hundreds of people like today, and I didn't really appreciate just how many people had there to support her. And I sort of said that in a strange way, I spoke to Anna direct. I said, if only you could see all these people here. And then I thought, when the people came up after I'd made the speech, they said, when you made the speech, you used a word. And we were amazed you used it. I said, suicide. And then, of course, it's kind of verboten. It's a kind of there is a real reluctance to use that word because it has so many connotations, including criminal ones, because it was an offence. At one time, you were ostracised, you were buried outside the confines of your city or town or village, your property was confiscated. Terrible. And that has lingered on. And they said, you talking about it gives us a sense of freedom and liberation. And in a sense, it echoed some of the cases I was doing, particularly at Grenfell. And in fact, what we began to do was hold meetings, sometimes as big as this, but sometimes quite small, where we asked people to speak about it. I'm not going to ask anybody here today to do that, but most audiences, I say, you know, how many people have been touched by suicide, i.e. somebody they know, somebody they love? And nearly 50% of every audience. So it's a huge situation. It's not just those who actually commit, numbers of which are rising at the moment, which won't surprise you. And so that's what we've been doing, is a charity called SOS, Silence of Suicide. Myself and my wife set it up. And the idea is to reach out and support people, people who are fighting a battle, just like all the ones in the book, often on their own, often isolated, often afraid to mention the word. So that we call them gatherings. We started with gatherings like this. Then we moved to a telephone service, not quite the same as the Samaritans, but similar. But it's broader, much broader than their service. But the latest development is a mobile service. We've got mobile vans who will enter the community, because there are lots of people who are immobile, lots of people are afraid, lots of people haven't got the money. So we go into the places where we will be received, and the vans have been converted into a safe space, a haven in which people feel they can offload and talk about something they can't talk about even to their family on some occasion. So the pamphlets are here somewhere in this marquee. Someone's got them.
They're at the back.
They're at the back, right. So before you leave, if you're interested in helping in any way, or you want to know more about it, or you want to set up what we've been doing elsewhere in this area, we'd be very pleased to hear from you. So that's the charity.
Lorna's
a trustee. Sorry,
I am. And in my role as a trustee, I just want to add that the charity also does an amazing job supporting the bereaved as well.
Yeah.
So not just those with mental health issues. Yeah. So I was going to go back to, you talked about the people. People's sort of resilience, people's courage, people's drive to get things changed. And we talked about leaflets and mobilising people and taking a stand, not buying certain goods. But there's a sort of organised way in which you can conduct a sort of citizen's court, isn't there? Which is another way of trying to get to the bottom of an issue. So I don't know if you wanted to talk about citizens' inquiries.
There's something called the People's Inquiry, which is what we did with the Palestine-Israel issue, established by Stefan Hessel. It dates back some time. Bertrand Russell established it in relation to the war in Vietnam as an idea. In other words, when citizenry, that's all of you, feel that government or representative institutions, they may be United Nations or you know what I mean, are not actually representing you, and they're not conveying your feelings, and they're not conveying your thoughts, and actually at the end of the day, you're having to fight them to get the progress that you want. You know the feeling. So what Bertrand Russell set up, and what Stefan Hessel set up, and what we've set up as well, but you may not have heard of it, is that where there is an issue, that a burning issue, I'm going to give you an illustration, it's in the book, but I'm not going to read it all out, otherwise you won't buy the book, will you? Oh, maybe. But in here, it's another major issue, which I know is at the centre of this, centre of this festival. That is green issues, environment, because the other big threat, besides warmongering and all the things I've just been talking about, besides that, there's an even bigger one, and that is what is happening to the place in which we're entrusted with, namely the planet. And just before I deal with exactly what happened in this, there's a very interesting example where I live, in Warwickshire, of what they did. on a local level. In other words, people like yourselves who just said, we're not going to put up with this anymore. But before I get to that, may I just say one of the other initiatives on the environmental front, again mentioned in the book, is ecocide. I don't know how much you know about it, but I can develop it if you need to know. But the concept was, the baton for ecocide was carried by somebody called Polly Higgins. She unfortunately died prematurely 2 or 3 years ago. But she and I helped promote the concept in which, again, the people in power, whether they're in institutions or government, are held to account. And so we had a mock trial in the Supreme Court to demonstrate how you put corporates on trial for what they're doing in oil spills, what they're doing in not protecting the climate. And there are groups in Switzerland that have just been to the International Criminal Court and established a possibility there as well. So these possibilities, they're myriad. Ecocide, extremely important concept. Now, what happened in Warwickshire was a similar impetus. People wanted to do something about, as I got asked here, you know, the carbon footprint. When I arrived, offsetting the carbon footprint and all the rest of it. These are important issues. And the citizenry of Warwickshire said, well, we're going to have a people's tribunal, just like the one, the international one in relation to Israel and the international one in relation to Vietnam. Just like that. We'll do it here. Amazing. They got together. They got some money from the local authority, got money from other sources, a bit of crowdfunding. They found an agency that's good at actually doing the logistics, and they set up a commission or an inquiry. They were the jury, selected in the end, randomly by this agency, did a trawl of the area, but at the same time they wanted it to be representative. So they didn't only want the farming element or the local council element or the eco warriors. They wanted a kaleidoscope of these opinions. They got them. They got them. I think it's 30 or 40 people. I think it's 30, wasn't it? 30 people sat on this jury. 30 people, they didn't all agree. 28 of them agreed. They heard over 4 months, series of experts. They cross-examined the experts, asking a simple question, because that's what you want to know. How can we change the situation where we live? Because, you know, you can't always attack the United Nations or the, you know, at that level you won't get, although we did get that through the Russell Tribunal, it doesn't often happen that way. And they managed to not only contrive this, if you like, auditorium, they at the end of it came up with a verdict which had, and it's in here, written out, the steps they want taken by the local authority to ensure, and national as well, to ensure a greener future. It's not talking about revolution overnight, talking about very practical measures. And they agreed on this, 28 out of the 30 agreed it, gave it to the local council, it was adopted. It's local policy in the part of Warwickshire where I live that these measures are now in place and are therefore, can be read by the local population, and you can ask, you know, is this happening? Is this happening? Why isn't it? And so on. So it's produced an agenda which has brought about change, and I think it inspires people, instills people in the belief they can do something about it. And just on the same topic, I mean, Lorna and I did another People's Commission. In other words, members of the medical profession, like you, probably got really fed up, more than that, angry, during COVID, that we had a government that actually wasn't doing the right thing and was channeling money to the fast track, you know, VIPs and members of the Conservative Party, as they nearly all were. So you know all the things that were going wrong and the Tea Parties and all the rest of it. So I don't need to go through all of that. But what we did, on behalf of the medical profession who were standing up for the NHS, saying we need to investigate it now in 2021-22, which we did. We had a four-month tribunal, all done remotely, called experts from the United Kingdom and elsewhere, United States of America, New Zealand, and so on. Lorna was the barrister presenting it. I was chairing a panel of esteemed medics. I'm not a medic, so they were making the judgments. Brought out a report. It's still available. It's entitled Misconduct in Public Office. And who's the misconduct? I'm sure you know the answer to that. So it was another move which gave a little bit of hope, because that's really important, hope and faith that something could change. And in fact, of course, slowly but surely, the current inquiry, public inquiry, judicial inquiry, is covering much of the same ground, but in much more detail. And obviously, you know, we're finding out how many documents, WhatsApp messages have been disappeared. So, but the people's inquiry came first. And we're suggesting that in future, when there are situations like this, and they're going to crop up a lot, there should be ability for a quick response. Inquiry is something else that we want to canvass with the new government, whether they're going to be prepared in economic stringently times to spend any money in this field, we're not sure. But we're going to press for it, because unless we do, no one else will.
And there are a number of things in the book that are covered that are campaigns that haven't quite finished, aren't there?
I think the publishers were saying, oh, Michael, you're so optimistic. And, you know, not everybody is that way, you know. And you've got to show them that it's not every case you touch or somebody else's touch is successful. And so I said, all right, I understand that. And there are campaigns that are ongoing at this minute. Obviously there are, to do with the environment and to do with injustice. One of them that pops up all the time at the moment is, you know, Malkinson, I think you may remember his name. You know, wrongly convicted, long time in prison. And when he comes out, they say, oh, by the way, before you go home, you've got to pay for your board and lodging. Pardon? Only governments, people in power who are totally out of touch would be arguing for this. Now, he's not the only one. There's a campaign on that score. They haven't succeeded, but are they going to stop? No, they're not. And there's also a story in here, the last person who was executed. You won't have necessarily heard of his name, which is why we've put it in the book. And it's right up front. Well, I'm going to mention the name, see if anybody's heard of it. Matin? No. And I'm not surprised. I'm not expecting anybody to have heard of it because, you know, then, way back, it was a very commonplace thing. Well, not commonplace, but people understood that, you know, hanging until it was abolished, obviously, shortly after. It was one of the cases that contributed to the abolition of... That was another campaign that took decades, like the campaign against slavery. Everything takes a very long time. You never know when the turning point's going to be, and you may be just there. Don't give up at that point, because that's, as I've said before, that's what they want. So Massin was wrongly convicted for a murder, interestingly, of a Ukrainian woman who ran a hosiery shop in Cardiff. And the police knew, it's the old question that we've had so many times, police knew he wasn't the person responsible, because just before the, I didn't do the trial, I'm not that old, quite old, but not that old. I didn't do the trial, but I did do the appeal on behalf of the family. His mother and other members of the family have stood firm and fast. They've put up with racist abuse. They've put up with ostracized because of the conviction for for murder. But she had one object, which was to decriminalize and ensure that her husband was eventually absolved, which he was, that his body was moved to sacred, but not the non-sacred ground where he's buried. So she had him reburied. And last year, when just before the book was published, South Wales Police finally apologised. But the nature of the apology is somewhat guarded and limited. So it isn't the unqualified apology. But there's more to it than that, because the family go on suffering. But that's a story which has taken time to get there. And at any point you would have said, oh, well, give up, stop, what are you bothering with? But they bothered. But there's another one, I'll just mention the name, in terms of Ricky Reel, a young man who ended up in the River Thames, and as his mother, another campaigner, hasn't yet managed to get the police to re-examine, although the new commissioner has finally said, earlier this year, had a meeting with her and said, okay, I'll have another look. Because it was a racist attack, I did the inquest and so on. So that's an example of somebody who hasn't succeeded, but it's also yet, But it's also an example of somebody, and I think you interviewed her at one point, or one of the daughters, the inspiration she gives just leaps off the page. And you think, well, if they can do it, I can do it.
I want to talk about, because I'm on a soapbox and I'm allowed, can I talk about IPP?
No. So, of course, you've done a brilliant job on a thing you probably don't know about.
Well, the audience that we talked to last weekend, most people hadn't heard of imprisonment for public protection. Has anybody heard of it here?
Ah.
Oh, yes, you are right, people. Right.
We can go home now.
For everybody else, I'm glad you're all sitting down. You don't have to be bereaved or to suffer a tragedy in order to be passionate about something. And for me, it has been, for the last 14 years, people suffering imprisonment for public protection. I say suffering because it's not just a punishment, it's effectively a life sentence. It's torture, it's psychological torture. In 2005, the then Labour government brought in a new type of criminal sentence which was designed to lock up about 100 people a year. And the sentences were effectively indeterminate. So the judge would come along and say, oh, you're convicted of one of these 153 offences. I have to find that you are dangerous. And therefore, you will go to prison for a minimum of, let's say, 2 years. But then the parole board will decide that you're not dangerous anymore. There's one catch. You have to show that you're not dangerous anymore. And in order to do that, you need to have access to courses in the prison estate, which, by the way, we're not going to give you, because we didn't realise that thousands of people were going to get subject to the sentence rather than just hundreds. So the system was an absolute mess. The prison population went through the roof, and 8,711 people were given imprisonment for public protection, men and women. Today, as I sit here, there are about 1,300 people still in custody who have never been released, despite the fact that it was abolished in 2012. So, for example, I represented somebody who was in prison from 2005 for having attempted to rob a cigarette in a street robbery because he was a drug addict, and he served 18 years in prison. Now, the former Justice Secretary, Alex Chalk, the last government, decided that they were going to do something about this, that there were these people languishing in prison. There's about 3,000 of them still in custody, even though there's 1,300 that have never been released. Once you get out, you're on a license forever. So if you don't meet a probation appointment, you fail a drugs test, you become homeless, something like that, you'll get recalled to prison. And you wonder why we have a prisons crisis. What are these people doing in custody? People get released from custody every day on determinate sentences. Why are they so special? It's but just a failure of time and a failure of legislation that has led to these people still being in custody. So I have campaigned for these people for a very long time, and I'm afraid I bullied Michael into putting a paragraph or two in the book about them.
Now, how are we doing on the time? Because I'm very keen if anybody's got...
We've got 3 minutes before we're going to ask questions.
Right, well, I think we can open it up now,
okay.
Can't we? Yeah, do ask any question, make any comment you like. Don't worry if it's, you know, even if it's not supportive. Please leave immediately.
Just before we take questions, we'd just like you to be reminded that it's being recorded. So if you are asking a question, that you're happy for your question to be recorded alongside your voice. We'd love to hear as many diverse voices as possible, as many voices as possible. So the quicker your question, the more people we can hear.
Hello. You mentioned something earlier about the International Court recognising the illegal occupation of the Palestine for 75 years. Does this have any implications for the selling of the arms by the British government to the Israeli government? And can we do something about it more directly with the British government because of it?
Yeah, spot on. It absolutely does. It did anyway before they did this declaration. But what it means is that if a state invades another area and occupies unlawfully because there was no... They had no right to do it. There may be reasons why you have to do it for a short time after an earlier conflict and so on in order to give back autonomy. So where you have a clearly unlawful situation, then other states, including ours, have an obligation not to support that state in its activities within the occupied territories. The most obvious of which is exporting. Well, originally the argument was before this judgment, well, it was linked to Gaza and genocide, and because this was being disputed in the International Court and is still there as a separate case, the government would say, well, we are looking closely at the licenses for weaponry, and therefore if we discern or consider that the arms may be used for offensive purposes, we won't grant the license. But we've looked, and we think, as what we're being told, they're being used for defensive purposes. So they continued granting the licenses. Now, we, some of us anyway, hoped that with the change in government and a change in attitude, somebody would come out quite soon and say, right, well, the first thing we're going to do is stop all arms trading with Israel and any other country that is acting illegally. And you don't provide arms so that they can survive longer. And so the answer, that's why we've asked for a meeting with the Attorney General to say, you know, what's going on here? I mean, it's so urgent, you can't wait anymore. And there can't be any more discussions, any more talks, and any more referring it to some other committee. The situation is abundantly clear. So the answer to your question is yes. So put pressure on anybody you know, your local MP, whoever that happens to be, and say you haven't, and it probably it's going to be Labour, and now they've got such a majority. So put a pressure on them and say, this is a matter of conscience. Do you want to wake up every morning and see more pictures of the kind you've been seeing? There's enough, you know, horror in the world anyway. And also look at other nations if you export to other nations. So the answer is yes.
Hi, thank you for coming to Greenbelt. You're in your natural home, so welcome. My question is quite provocative. It's not coming from my point of view, I want to be clear. Do you think that the population at large, so not audiences like this one, not audiences at the kind of festivals that maybe would come to listen to two barristers speak, do you think the population at large cares about the rule of law and the importance of legal truth?
Yes, I think they... you probably think I'm an idealist and I'm a positivist and I'm living in another world. Well, I've been told that many times, but, you know... Hey, I'm right here. I'm very... and I understand exactly what you're saying. I have a firm belief that there's, you know, within this human soul, wherever they are, not just here in this festival, there is a sense of fairness. There will be those who are bitter. There will be those who do not think along those exact lines. I don't expect everybody to be homogenous in that sense. However, I have a firm belief, that's why I'm so keen on jury trial and so on, that the ordinary person given the chance and given an understanding is very forgiving. And people are crying out in the scenes that you get from Gaza, from the Sudan, from Somalia, it doesn't matter where it is, there are lots of these situations. You can't look at them and just switch off. There will be, obviously, as I say, a reactionary force amongst some. We have to address that, not by force, but by illustrating that, you know, the way you change things is by empathy, is by persuasion, is by example. And I think one of the things I use as an example of to sort of counter, it's not a controversial question at all, it's a very real question, is what happened recently with regard to the streets of the United Kingdom. So you have three murders of young girls. Terrible. Dreadful. And then you get the voice of the dark forces, implying that it's actually the fault of the people on small boats or whatever, or the illegal immigrant or whatever, or that actually, you know, we've got to understand that there's evil forces at work and so on. So, yes, they're out there. They get quite a lot of airtime from the media, some of which are stirring it up, and also fake news and stuff like that. But what impressed me, I don't know about you, was that people decided, even in Southport, they're not going to put up with this. That's not their Southport. Their Southport is where people stand together, as people did during COVID. They stand together because they understand, at the bottom line, it's necessary, as it were, to have a unification of people who are perceiving the core existence of what we're all about. And I think, religions obviously have it very close to their heart. And those who have a sense of spirit, which I think I fall into that kind of category. I'm not exactly religious, but I do have a belief in the human spirit. And to that extent, I'm extremely hopeful that the people who came together and what put a stop pretty abruptly to the thugs who come out on the political thugs who come out on the street, never mind the ones on the screen, was the mass exposure of people saying, we're going to stand against this and be seen to stand against it. And what I was appalled about was that, that Keir, instead of Keir Starmer said, well, it was his policy of locking people up for longer periods of time and putting thousands of police on the streets. Oh, Keir, come on, that's language from the 1930s. Yes, you do need police around. And yes, you possibly need prisons, but actually only in remote circumstances. You've got to look, the prisons are overflowing. They can't cope. They're using police stations. And that's what Lorna was touching on. So there's a place for that. The real power he didn't put his finger on was the power of the people, because obviously he's interested in a different kind of power. If it doesn't answer the question, I'll see you later.
Thank you. Anybody Thank else? You very much for coming to Greenbelt. I wanted to ask you what you would say to clients, particularly in the light of Hillsborough, and the slogan was always justice for the 97. What would you say to those who say that after 35 years, they still don't have justice?
Ah, right. That happens all the time. Because you get, either you get your people's tribunal, you get your judicial inquiry or inquest, and of course, some of them are in the book, but there are a lot more than that. And we were both in Ireland last week, and it's an interesting question. Because in the Bloody Sunday inquiry, I'll just give it an example, where innocent citizens of our country were shot dead by paramilitaries. Well, that's been established by a second inquiry in which I played a part. And there was a particular point in the inquiry in which a soldier responsible for killing the husband of somebody I was representing and father of six, actually did the unknown, the sort of Perry Mason moment where somebody confesses in the witness box. I hadn't ever had that before. She collapsed in the public gallery and she had to be carried out on a stretcher, and outside I went to see her. They stopped the inquiry straight at that minute. And she said, Michael, that's it. That's all I wanted. I wanted to hear the truth. I've heard it. Thank you. And she went home. However, other families said, well, that's all very well, but what about the prosecution of the soldier? So they're divided in the sense that there will be those who feel justice has two elements. Truth is the beginning and accountability is the second. And I think that may arise out of Grenfell. It arises out of the infected blood. It arises out of COVID. All those public inquiries that are happening at the moment are unraveling the same point about a system that is thoroughly, I'm afraid, has been corrupted thoroughly. People lie through their teeth. We have to get a Labour government to say we're going to institute, put on the statute books, a duty of candour. Excuse me? We have to enforce the truth. I'm afraid we do. And so they've committed to that. So let's have, and that comes out of Hillsborough. So they've achieved that. But there are still families there, and I don't blame them, who say the people responsible for opening the gates in the way that it happened have not faced justice in the way that they have expressed it. So they will feel justice hasn't been served. But they also, there are a number who realize, you have to be careful not to allow that need to become so obsessive that you leave life behind. So there comes a point at which, difficult for me as a lawyer, because I'm wanting to say to them, don't give up. But at the same time, there are cases where you say, okay, you know, you've still got some life left. I think it may be time to let go. You've got as far as you can get. Let others carry the battle. So, and then they're happy if there is somebody else. And there are. Well, I have great faith in the younger generation. They're getting up there and being seen and being, you know, on the streets and all the rest of it. So I can't answer it better than that, I'm afraid.
So hi. I'm a prison chaplain. I work with a number of gentlemen with IPP sentences. Thank you, firstly, for raising this today about IPP sentences. I've been dealing particularly with one chap lately who epitomises the lack of hope. And I'd just like to know, when I go back to work next week, what messages of hope can I bring them? How can I help instill hope in those men, please?
So once a month I hold an IPP forum in a prison which is local to me in Coldingley in Woking. And so I hold an open forum where IPPs come in and express their lack of hope, complete desperation, sadness, sometimes suicidality, all sorts. What I would say is, and this is what I said to them 2 weeks ago, number one, we are seeing far more than we have ever done before. Articles in the news, reports, news items, TV programmes about this problem. All it needs is to be treated in the same way as the post office scandal, and then everybody will know about it. So I would say there's a lot of things going on that they won't know about because, of course, they're in prison. They don't get all the updates. But if you come and find me afterwards, I'll give you my email address and I'll tell you the stuff that we're doing. One of the things that we're doing is my little group in prison. We're writing to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, but also who has already, by the way, said that this is psychological torture and that the UK government said, oh, yes, well, we're doing a bit about it. But no, we think they should all still stay in prison if we think they're dangerous. But the other thing is we are now looking at arbitrary detention and making a complaint to the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, because this isn't going away. As I understand on the grapevine, there is to be a programme that has been commissioned, I think, either by ITV or Channel 4, but who knows when that will come out. So there is a lot still happening, and I and Michael were two of the signatories, a letter that was also in the press a few weeks ago, basically saying you've got to look at resentencing these people and you've got to enact the various parts of the Victims and Prisoners Bill so that people have the sunset clause when they come out on licence. But if you come to me afterwards, I'm very happy to share what I've got with you. But thank you for raising it.
Hello. Hello.
There's some questions.
Michael, Lorna, thanks very much for speaking to us today. My question is, with regard, how do you feel the victims of the Horizon Post Office scandal should be, the best way is for them to be given full justice for what has been an appalling scandal that was repeatedly covered up for years? And how can we stop this situation keep happening whereby there's a miscarriage of justice that goes on for decades, whether it's with Horizon, Hillsborough, Infected Blood, and other things? How do we ensure that we don't keep having these scandals that take decades to resolve? I mean, for all I know, there might be a scandal that's going on now that hasn't hit the news, might not hit the news for another 10 years' time. Mm-hmm. And just like, how do you think is the best way to ensure that when the scandal happens, that justice is done and quickly and not 10, 20, 30, 40 years later when many people have sadly died?
Well, I think it's one of the most important questions. And it's another of the reasons for writing the book was to say, the system has failed. And even Rishi Sunak said that when the infected blood judgment was made earlier this year. The system has failed. It's not just the individual. From top to bottom. Because in each of these, and I'm hoping Grenfell next week will echo this point. So at the political level, administrative level, executive level, right the way through, and what we're dealing with here not only is systemic, but it's actually a question of a framework of mind that causes this. A framework in which, in each of these cases, what is the common factor? Very often, it is about power and retaining power. At the end of the day, those in power want to keep it. So they do everything possible, which means they move closer and closer to a middle ground that's not going to change anything. So they don't want any change. So that's why one's got to start looking about how you change the seat of power. The nature of, I've always called it, apparent democracy. Don't be deluded. I mean, Wedgwood Benn used to say this a lot. If voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal, wouldn't they? So, if you think about it, it's probably true. So we have to start thinking about whether the ballot, and that's what an organization that is cross-boundary called Compass is set up to do this, to establish new forms of democracy. You can't reincarnate the Athenian or Grecian view because, you know, we're much bigger, we've got too many people and so on. It's got to be split differently. But being in touch with the electorate, with the people who are represented, so that you have a much better representation, a much better voice, they're more accountable and so on. That's a starting place. The second thing is you've got to change the attitude of mind that percolates industry and politics. Something, it's in the book, but you may not have heard of it, something called the Nolan Principles, were enunciated in the 1990s to address this very point. Seven principles, which you'd say, well, it's really obvious, isn't it? Truth, accountability, transparency, all that. These principles, but they were never acted on, which is why the government's present intention to make the duty of candor, which is at the root of all these, is not just that it's not representative, but you get people telling downright lies. It's got worse, actually, over the last year. With the advent of fake news and the ability for politicians to say it appears anything they like, and they're not challenged by it. So all of that approach, it's a mindset, has to begin to change. The duty of candor will encourage people to do that. But it's underpinned by the next issue, feature for me anyway, and that is avarice, greed. It's profit before people. It runs through all these cases, post office case, COVID case, Hillsborough in a sense as well. There are other reasons to do with, you know, safety, Grenfell, where again, the welfare of the people, the health of the people, the safety of the people costs money. So it's what they called the safety precautions that ought to have been placed in Grenfell. Well, we'll wait and see what the judge says, but I remember what David Cameron said. David Cameron was saying, it's an unhealthy albatross around our necks. We've got to deregulate even more. So it's all part of that thrust. So you have to have a sense of responsibility for those you're voting for who are actually in touch with what the real priorities are. And yes, we obviously have to survive economically. You survive economically by having a vibrant, if you like, constituency of people who feel they matter and therefore make a contribution that keeps the economy afloat in a different sense to the one they're constantly going on about. So I think that it's a value judgment. And I think that when people get together and begin to understand they want changing in values, that was beginning to happen in 2012, just prior to the coalition government. And it's been developed as even more people now recognize that actually they can do more than they thought they could politically. And we mustn't let go of it. It's a chink of light, but it is one of the ways I see change can be brought about. So you have to example it, which is what the people in Warwickshire did. They said, well, we'll show you we can do it. So I think it starts at grassroots level. That's my view anyway. Percolates up. You won't get the people on top doing anything. You have to show them underneath that what they're standing on the sand, we're standing on the firm ground.
Thank you, Michael. We're nearly at time. I'm going to take one more question. I'm really sorry if you had a question to ask, but Lorna and Michael are not rushing off, so they...
I got news for you, baby.
So you're going to move to the side, kindly, and then you'll be able to have another conversation with them. So I'm really sorry if that was the case. If you're leaving...
No, not straight. We're going to sign books.
Yeah, good. So you'll be able to get a chance to...
Yeah, I'm only joking.
One last question.
Hi, thank you for coming to talk today. I wondered if you could speak on your opinions of the adversarial court system that we have in the England and Wales in juxtaposition with the inquisitorial system and its effectiveness and fairness within sentencing and conviction, particularly around the fact that for a person who commits a heinous crime to be put in prison, they would need to be provided with a legal defence.
Right.
I'm really sorry, I've got to go.
Right, come and see me afterwards. This is a massive question. Yeah. It does touch on something I was going to mention I haven't so far. I mean, I'm horrified by the 77-year-old woman who's been sentenced to 18, I think it's months, for her protest in relation to climate change. And she didn't do anything violent. And it's just... And, you know, it just horrifies me. But I have to say, at the end of the day, I am a firm believer in the jury system, which, of course, from time to time, they go, oh, we'll see if we can do away with juries here, and they're very expensive, do away with a few there. They come back with verdicts we don't like, and all this kind of thing. So I'm firmly in, it is the one truly democratic aspect of our system, is that for very important issues, are at the end of the day, criminal issues are decided by juries. So that's very important. Adversarial, I think, is also important. I understand the benefits of the inquisitorial system, which is basically practiced on the continent, although they have juries as well. If the adversarial system is properly managed, properly policed, so that you get fairness percolating through the process, both sides have equal disclosure, both sides have equal resources. Problem is that that doesn't happen. And of course, there's been, you all know, austerity, courts, there's a backlog, sometimes up to 2 years for cases to get on. Lawyers are leaving the profession because they can't earn a living anymore at it. It costs more to go to the court than they get for doing the hearing in the courts. So lawyers are leaving en masse. It's exactly the same story, you know, in a sense, reflected in the NHS and in schools and education. So, but that doesn't mean the adversarial system is the wrong one. There is a role for inquisitorial, and that is, of course, where it's mixed into the judicial inquiry. And, of course, they're having difficulty. There's a tension between the inquiry doing the inquisition, yet at the same time allowing the families to be represented and be adversarial and ask probing questions. That still needs to be sorted, but the advantage of an adversarial system is undoubtedly uncomfortable questions do get asked. Whereas if you leave it to the government and a government-inspired judge who sits as the inquisitor, they don't necessarily get asked unless you've got the right judge. And that goes back to value judgments, and it goes back to training and education and so on. Sorry, there's a lot more to it than that. It's a very important question.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.